Lisa slept. But she heard nothing. Perhaps he hadn't come back yet. Or maybe he was sitting still and silent like her. A few seconds later she heard a rustling sound, a sigh, then a low whistling. And she thought he was probably standing at the window, looking out at the garden. What could he be thinking about? She tried to imagine, but couldn't. In spite of herself, she couldn't credit him with having the thoughts, the desires of an ordinary human being. She couldn't believe he was simply looking out at the garden in complete innocence, admiring the shimmering fish pond where silent, slippery shapes slid past. Carp for tomorrow's dinner. "He's elated," she said to herself. "He's recalling his battles, reliving past dangers. In a moment he'll be writing home to his wife in Germany. No, he can't be married, he's too young. To his mother, then, or fiancée, or mistress. He'll say, 'I'm living in a French house, Amalia.' She must be called Amalia, or Kunigunde, or Gertrude." She deliberately chose grotesque, harsh-sounding names. "Our suffering hasn't been in vain, for we are the victors." She couldn't hear anything at all now. He wasn't moving. He was holding his breath. A toad croaked in the darkness. It was a soft, low, musical note, a bubble of water bursting with a silvery sound. Croak, croak. Lucille half closed her eyes. How peaceful it was. Sad and overwhelming. Every so often, something came to life inside her, rebelled, demanded noise, movement, people. Life, my God, life! How long would this war go on? How many years would they have to live like this, in this dismal lethargy, bowed, docile, crushed like cattle in a storm? She missed the familiar crackling of the radio. When the Germans arrived, it had been hidden in the cellar because people said they confiscated or destroyed them. She smiled. They must find French houses rather sparsely furnished, she thought, recalling everything Madame Angelier had crammed into wardrobes and locked away out of sight of the enemy. At dinner time, the officer's orderly had come into the dining room with a short note. "Lieutenant Bruno von Falk presents his compliments to Mesdames Angelier and requests they kindly give the bearer of this letter the keys to the piano and the library. The lieutenant gives his word of honour that he will not remove the instrument or damage the books." Madame Angelier did not appreciate this courtesy. She raised her eyes to heaven, moved her lips as if she were praying and acquiescing to God's will. "Might over right, isn't it?" she asked the soldier, who didn't understand French, and so simply replied, "Jawohl," with a wide grin, while nodding his head several times. "Tell Lieutenant von, she mumbled scornfully, "that he is in charge here." She took the two keys he wanted from her chain and threw them onto the table. Then she whispered to her daughter-in-law in a tragic tone of voice, "He'll be playing Wacht am Rhein." "I think they have a different national anthem now, Mother." But the lieutenant didn't play anything at all. The deepest silence still prevailed. When the ladies heard the great courtyard door slamming like a gong in the peaceful evening, they knew the officer had gone out and sighed with relief. "Now," thought Lucille, "he's walked away from the window. He's pacing up and down. His boots, the sound of his boots. It would pass. The occupation would end. There would be peace, blessed peace. The war and the tragedy of 1940 would be no more than a memory, a page in history. The names of battles and treaties children would recite in school. But as for me, for as long as I live, I will never forget the low, regular sound of those boots pacing across the floorboards. Why doesn't he go to bed? Why doesn't he put slippers on in the evening, like a civilized person, like a Frenchman? He's having a drink." She could hear the squirting of seltzer water and the faint tch-tch of a lemon being squeezed. "So that's why we're short of lemons," her mother-in-law would have said. "They're taking everything from us." Now he's turning the pages of a book. Oh, it's horrible thinking this way. She shuddered. He'd opened the piano. She recognised the dull sound of the cover thrown backwards and the creaking of the piano stool as it swivelled. Oh, no. Really, he's not going to start playing in the middle of the night. True, it was only 9 o'clock. Perhaps in the rest of the universe people didn't go to bed so early. Yes, he was playing. She listened, her head lowered, nervously biting her lips. It wasn't quite an arpeggio. It was more like a sigh rising up from the keyboard, a flurry of notes. He touched them lightly, caressed them, finished with a rapid light trill that sounded like a bird singing. Then everything went silent. For a long time Lucille sat very still, brush in hand, her hair loose over her shoulders. Then she sighed, thinking vaguely, "It's such a shame." A shame that the silence was so complete. A shame that the boy had stopped playing. A shame that he was here, he, the invader, the enemy, he, and not someone else. She made an annoyed little gesture with her hand as if she were trying to push away great masses of heavy air, so heavy she couldn't breathe. Shame. She climbed into the large, empty bed. Chapter 5. Madeleine Savary was alone in the house. She was sitting in the room where Jean-Marie had lived for several weeks. Every day she made the bed where he had slept. This irritated Cécile. "Why bother? No one ever sleeps here, so you don't need to put clean sheets on every day as if you were expecting someone." "Are you expecting someone?" Madeleine didn't reply and continued every morning to shake out the big feather mattress. She was happy to be alone with her little boy. He was feeding, his head against her bare breast. When she changed sides, a part of his face was as moist, red and shiny as a cherry, and the shape of her nipple was imprinted on his cheek. She kissed him gently. She thought now, as she had before, "I'm glad it's a boy. Men don't have it so bad." She dozed while watching the fire. She never got enough sleep. There was so much work to do. They hardly got to bed before 10, 11 o'clock. And sometimes they got up in the middle of the night to listen to English radio. In the morning they had to be up by 5 o'clock to tend the animals. It was nice today to be able to take a little nap. The meal was already cooking, the table was set, everything around her was in order. The faint light of a rainy spring day lit up the shoots in the vegetable plot and the grey sky. In the courtyard the ducks quacked in the rain, while the chickens and turkeys, a little mound of ruffled feathers, sheltered sadly under the shed. Madeleine heard the dog bark. "Are they home already?" she wondered. Benoit had taken the family to the village. Someone crossed the courtyard, someone who was not wearing the same kind of shoes as Benoit, and every time she heard footsteps that weren't her husband's or someone else's from the farm, every time she saw a strange shape in the distance, she would immediately panic and think, "It's not Jean-Marie. It can't be him. I'm mad to think it might be. First of all, he's not coming back. And then, even if he did, what would change? I'm married to Benoit. I'm not expecting anyone, quite the opposite. I pray to God that Jean-Marie never comes back, because, little by little, I'll get used to my husband and then I'll be happy. But I don't know what I'm going on about, honest to God. What am I thinking? I am happy." At the very moment she had these thoughts, her heart, which was less rational, would start beating so violently that it drowned out every other sound, so violently that she wouldn't hear Benoit's voice, the baby crying, the wind beneath the door. The uproar in her heart was deafening, as if a wave had washed over her. For a few seconds she would be about to faint. She would only come round when she saw the postman bringing the new seed catalogue. He'd been wearing new shoes that day. Or the Vicomte de Montmort, the landowner. "Well, Madeleine, aren't you going to say hello?" Mother Savary would say, surprised. "I think I woke you up," the visitor would say, as she feebly apologised and mumbled, "Yes, you frightened me." Woke her up? From what dream? Now she felt that emotion within her once more, that secret panic caused by the stranger who had entered, or was coming back into, her life. She half sat up in the chair, stared at the door. Was it a man? It was a man's footsteps, that light cough, the aroma of fine cigarettes. A man's hand, pale, well manicured, was on the latch. Then a German uniform came into sight. As always, when it wasn't Jean-Marie, her disappointment was so intense that she sat dazed for a moment. She didn't even think of buttoning up her blouse. The German was an officer, a young man who couldn't be more than 20, with an almost colourless face and equally fair and dazzling eyebrows, hair and small moustache. He looked at her bare bosom, smiled and saluted with an exaggerated, almost insolent politeness. Certain Germans knew how to place in their salute to the French a mere show of politeness, or perhaps it just seemed like that to the defeated French in all their bitterness, humiliation and anger. It was not the courtesy accorded to an equal, but that shown to the dead, like the presentation of arms after an execution. "Can I help you, monsieur?" Madeleine said, finally buttoning up her blouse. "Madame, I have been billeted on the farm," replied the young man, who spoke extremely good French. "I apologise for the inconvenience. Would you be so kind as to show me my room?"
"We were told we'd have ordinary soldiers," Madeleine said shyly.
"I am the lieutenant who serves as interpreter to the commandant."
"You'll be far away from the village, and I'm afraid the room won't be good enough for an officer. It's just a farm here, and you won't have any running water or electricity or anything a gentleman needs."
The young man glanced around. He looked closely at the faded red tiles on the floor, worn pink in places, the big stove standing in the middle of the room, the bed in the corner, the spinning wheel — they had brought it down from the attic where it had been since the other war. All the young women in the area were learning to spin. It was impossible to find wool in the shops any more. The German then looked carefully at the framed photographs on the walls, the certificates for agricultural prizes, the empty little niche that used to hold a statue of a saint, surrounded by a delicate frieze, now half worn away. Finally, his eyes fell once more upon the young farm girl holding the baby in her arms. He smiled.
"You needn't worry about me. This will do nicely."
His voice was strangely harsh and resonant, like metal being crushed. His steel-grey eyes, sharply etched face, and the unusual shade of his pale blonde hair, which was as smooth and bright as a helmet, made this young man's appearance striking to Madeleine. There was something about his physique that was so perfect, so precise, so dazzling, she thought to herself, that he reminded her more of a machine than a human being. In spite of herself, she was fascinated by his boots and belt buckle. The leather and steel seemed to sparkle. "I hope you have an orderly," she said. "No one here could make your boots shine like that." He laughed and said again, "You needn't worry about me." Madeleine had put her son in his crib. She could see the German's reflection in the mirror above the bed. She saw the way he looked at her and smiled. She was afraid and thought, "What will Benoit say if he starts chasing after me?" She didn't like this young man. He frightened her a bit. Yet despite herself, she was attracted by a certain resemblance to Jean-Marie, not to Jean-Marie as a man, but as a member of a higher social class, a gentleman. Both were carefully shaven, well brought up, with pale hands and delicate skin. She realised the presence of this German in the house would be doubly painful for Benoit, because he was the enemy, but also because he wasn't a peasant like him, because he hated whatever aroused Madeleine's interest in and curiosity about the upper classes to such an extent that for a while now he'd been snatching fashion magazines from her hands. And if she asked him to shave or change his shirt, he'd say,
"Better get used to it. You married a farmer, a country bumpkin. I got no fancy manners."
With such resentment, such deep-seated jealousy, that she knew who had given him these ideas, that Cécile must have been talking. Cécile wasn't the same with her as before, either. She sighed. So many things had changed since the beginning of this damned war.
"I'll show you your room," she said finally.
But he said no. He took a chair and sat down near the stove.
"In a minute, if it's all right with you. Let's get to know each other. What's your name?"
"Madeleine Savary."
"I am Kurt Bonnet. It's a French name, as you can see. My ancestors must have been your countrymen, chased out of France under Louis XIV. There is French blood in Germany and French words in our language.
Oh, she said indifferently. She wanted to say, there's German blood in France too, but in the earth, and since 1914. But she didn't dare. It was better to say nothing. It was strange. She didn't hate the Germans. She didn't hate anyone. But the sight of that uniform seemed to change her from a free and proud person into a sort of slave, full of cunning, caution and fear, skilful at cajoling the conquerors, while hissing, "I hope they drop dead," behind closed doors, as her mother-in-law did. She at least didn't pretend, or act nice to the conquerors, Madeleine thought. She was ashamed of herself. She frowned, put on an icy expression, and moved her chair away so the German would understand she didn't want to talk to him any more, and she didn't like him being there. He, however, looked at her with pleasure. Like many young men subjected to strict discipline from childhood, he had acquired the habit of bolstering his ego with outward arrogance and stiffness. He believed that any man worthy of the name should be made of steel, and he had behaved accordingly during the war in Poland and France, and during the occupation. But far more than any principles, he obeyed the impulsiveness of youth. When she first saw him, Madeleine thought he was 20. He was even younger. He had turned 19 during the French campaign. He behaved kindly or cruelly, depending on how people and things struck him. If he took a dislike to someone, he made sure he hurt them as much as possible. During the retreat of the French army, when he was in charge of taking the pathetic herd of prisoners back to Germany, during those terrible days when he was under orders to kill anyone who was flagging, anyone who wasn't walking fast enough, he shot the ones he didn't like the look of, without remorse, with pleasure even. On the other hand, he would behave with infinite kindness and sympathy towards certain prisoners who seemed likeable to him, some of whom owed him their lives. He was cruel, but it was the cruelty of adolescence, cruelty that results from a lively and subtle imagination focused entirely inward, towards his own soul. He didn't pity the suffering of others. He simply didn't see them. He saw only himself. Mixed in with this cruelty was a slight affectation that was a product of his youth, as well as a certain leaning towards sadism. For example, although he was harsh towards people, he displayed the greatest solicitude towards animals. It was at his instigation that the headquarters at Calais had issued an order several months earlier. Bonnet had noticed that on market days the farmers carried their chickens, feet tied and head down. As a gesture of humanity, it was forthwith forbidden to continue this practice. The farmers paid no attention, which only increased Bonnet's loathing of the barbaric and thoughtless French, while the French were outraged to read such a decree beneath another announcing that 8 men had been executed as a reprisal for an act of sabotage. In the northern city where he'd been billeted, Bonnet had only been friendly with the woman whose house he lived in, because one day, when he'd been suffering from flu, she had taken the trouble to bring him breakfast in bed. Bonnet had immediately thought of his mother, his childhood years, and, tears in his eyes, thanked Lily, a former madam in a house of prostitution. From that moment on, he did everything he could for her, granting her passes of all kinds, coupons for petrol, etc. He spent the evenings with the old hag, because, he would say, she was old and alone and bored. Though he wasn't a rich man, he brought her expensive trinkets every time he returned from missions to Paris. These acts of kindness were sometimes the result of musical, literary, or, as on this spring morning when he walked into the Savary's farmhouse, artistic impressions. Bonnet was a cultured man, gifted at all the arts. The Savary's farm, with its slightly damp, sombre atmosphere created by the rainy day, its faded pink floor tiles, its empty little niche from which he imagined a statue of the Virgin Mary had been removed during the last revolution, its little palm branch above the cradle, and the sparkling copper warming pan, half in shadow, had something about it, thought Bonnet, that reminded him of a domestic scene of the Flemish school. This young woman sitting on a low chair, a child in her arms, her delightful breast lustrous in the shadow, her ravishing face with its rosy complexion, her pure white chin and forehead, was herself worthy of a portrait. As he admired her, he was almost transported to a museum in Munich or Dresden, alone in front of one of those paintings that aroused within him that intellectual and sensual intoxication he preferred above all else. This woman could treat him coldly, even with hostility, it wouldn't matter. He wouldn't even notice. He would only ask of her, as he asked of everyone around him, to provide him with purely artistic acts of kindness, to retain the lighting of a masterpiece, with luminous flesh set against a background of velvety shadows. At that very moment, a large clock struck midday. Bonnet laughed, almost with pleasure. It was just such a deep, low, slightly cracked sound he had imagined coming from the antique clock with the painted casing in some Dutch old master, along with the smell of fresh herring prepared by the housewife, and the sounds from the street beyond the window with its tarnished panes of glass. In such paintings, there was always a clock like this one hanging on the wall. He wanted to make Madeleine speak. He wanted to hear her voice again, her young, slightly lilting voice.
"Do you live here alone? Your husband must be a prisoner."
"Oh, no," she said quickly.
At the thought of Benoit, a German prisoner who had escaped, she was afraid again. It struck her that the German would guess and arrest him. "I'm so stupid," she thought, and instinctively softened. She had to be nice to the conqueror.
"Will you be here long?" she asked in a frank, humble voice. "Everyone's saying 3 months."
"We don't know ourselves," Bonnet explained. "That's military life for you. In war, it all depends on orders, a general's whim, or chance. We were on our way to Yugoslavia, but it's all finished over there."
"Oh, is it?"
"It will be in a few days. In any case, it would be all over by the time we got there. And I think they'll keep us here all summer unless they send us to Africa or England."
"And do you like it?" said Madeleine, intentionally feigning innocence, but with a little shudder of disgust she couldn't hide, as if she were asking a cannibal, "Is it true you eat human flesh?"
"Man is made to be a warrior, just as woman is made to please the warrior," Bonnet replied, and he smiled because he found it comical to quote Nietzsche to this pretty French farm girl. "Your husband must think the same way if he's young."
Madeleine didn't reply. Actually, she had very little idea what Benoit thought, even though they'd been brought up together. Benoit was taciturn and cloaked in a triple armour of decency, masculine, provincial, and French. She didn't know what he hated or what he liked, just that he was capable of both love and hatred.
"My God," she said to herself, "I hope he doesn't take against this German."
She continued to listen, but said little, straining all the while to hear any sounds on the road. Carts passed by. The church bells chimed for evening prayers. You could hear the bells ring out one after the other across the countryside, first the light silvery note of the little chapel on the Montmartre estate, then the deep sound from the village, then the hurried little peal from Sainte-Marie that you could only hear in bad weather when the wind blew in from the tops of the hills. "Family will be home soon," murmured Madeleine. She placed a creamy earthenware jug of forget-me-nots on the table. "You won't be eating here, will you?" she suddenly asked. He reassured her.
"No, no, I've paid to have my meals in town. I'll only have some coffee in the morning."
"Well, that's easy enough, monsieur."
It was an expression they used a lot around Bussy. She said it in an affectionate sort of way, with a smile. It didn't mean a thing, though. It was a mere politeness, and didn't actually mean you would get anything. A mere politeness, and if the promise wasn't kept. There was another expression ready and waiting, this time spoken with a tinge of regret and apology. "Ah, well, you can't always do what you want." But the German was delighted.
"How kind everyone is here," he said naively.
"You think so, monsieur?"
"And I hope you'll bring me my coffee in bed."
"We only do that for sick people," said Madeleine ironically.
He wanted to take her hands. She quickly pulled away. "Here's my husband." He wasn't there yet, but he would be soon. She recognized the sound of the mare's hooves on the road. She went out into the courtyard. It was raining. Through the gates came the old horse and trap, unused since the other war, but now a replacement for the broken-down car. Benoit held the reins. The women were sitting under wet umbrellas. Madeleine ran towards her husband and put her arm round his neck.
"There's a Boche," she whispered in his ear.
Is he going to be living with us?
Yes,
damn.
So what? Said Cecile. They're not so bad if you know how to handle them, and they pay well.
Benoit unharnessed the mare and took her to the stable. Cecile, intimidated by the German, but conscious of having an advantage because she was wearing her best Sunday dress, a hat and silk stockings, proudly walked into the room. Chapter 6. The regiment was passing beneath Lucille's windows. The soldiers were singing. They had excellent voices. But the French were bemused by this serious choir, whose sad and menacing music sounded more religious than warlike.
"That how they pray?" the women asked.
The troops were returning from manoeuvres. It was so early in the morning that the whole village was still asleep. A few women woke with a start. They leaned out of the windows and laughed. It was such a fresh, gentle morning. The roosters crowed huskily after the cold night. A peaceful sky was tinged with pink and silver. Its innocent light played on the happy faces of the men as they marched past. How could you not be happy on such a glorious spring day? The women watched them for a long time, these tall, well-built men with their hard faces and melodious voices. They were beginning to recognize some of the soldiers. They were no longer the anonymous crowd of the early days, the flood of green uniforms indistinguishable from each other, just as no wave in the sea is unique, but merges with the swells before and after it. These soldiers had names now.
"Here comes that short blonde who lives with the shoemaker and whose friends call him Willy," the townspeople would say. "That one over there, he's the redhead who orders omelettes with 8 eggs and drinks 18 glasses of brandy one after the other without getting drunk or being sick. That little one who stands so straight, he's the interpreter. He calls the shots at headquarters. And there's the Angelier's German."
Just as farmers used to be given the names of the places where they lived, to such an extent that the postman, who was a descendant of former tenant farmers on the Montmartre estate, was called Auguste de Montmartre to this very day, so the Germans more or less inherited the social status of their landlords. They were called the Durands Fritz, the Laforges Ewald, the Angeliers Bruno. Bruno rode at the head of his cavalry detachment. The well-fed, fiery animals pranced and eyed the onlookers with pride and impatience. They were the envy of the villagers.
"Mama, did you see?"
the children shouted. The lieutenant's horse had a golden brown coat as glossy as satin. Both horse and rider were aware of the cheers, the women's cries of pleasure. The handsome animal arched its neck, violently shook its bit. The officer smiled faintly and sometimes made a little affectionate smacking sound with his lips, which controlled the horse better than the whip. When a young girl at a window exclaimed,
"He's a good rider, that Boche, he is!"
he raised his gloved hand to his helmet and solemnly saluted. Behind the young girl you could hear nervous whispering.
"You know very well they don't like being called that. Are you crazy?"
"Oh, so what? So I forgot,"
the young girl retorted, red as a cherry. The detachment broke ranks at the village square. In a great clanking of boots and spurs, the men went back to their billets. The sun was shining and it was hot now, almost like summer. The soldiers got washed in the courtyards. Their naked torsos were red, burned by being outdoors so much, and covered with sweat. One soldier had hooked a mirror onto the branch of a tree and was shaving. Another plunged his head and bare arms into a large tub of cool water. A third called out to a young woman,
"Beautiful day, madame."
"Well, now, so you speak French?"
"A little."
They looked at each other, smiled at each other. The women went over to the wells and sent down their buckets on long creaking chains. Once retrieved and full of shimmering icy water that reflected the dark blue of the sky, these buckets always attracted a soldier who would hurry over to take the heavy burden. Some of the soldiers did it to prove that, even though they were German, they were polite. Others did it out of natural kindness. Some, because the beautiful day and a kind of physical invigoration brought on by the fresh air, healthy tiredness, and the prospect of a well-earned rest, put them in a state of exaltation, of inner strength, a state where men who would gladly act maliciously towards the strong feel even more kindly towards the weak, the same state, doubtless, that in spring causes male animals to fight each other, yet graze, play, and gamble in the dust in front of the females. A soldier walked a young woman home, solemnly carrying two bottles of white wine she had just pulled out of the well. He was a very young man, with light blue eyes, a turned-up nose, large, strong arms.
"They are nice," he said, looking at the woman's legs. "They are nice, madame."
"Shh, my husband."
"Ah, husband, böse, bad," he exclaimed, pretending to be very frightened.
The husband was listening behind the closed door, and since he trusted his wife, instead of getting angry, he felt rather proud.
"Well, our women are beautiful," he thought,
and the small glass of white wine he had every morning seemed to taste better. Some soldiers went into the shoemaker's. He was a disabled war veteran who had his workbench in the shop. The deep, natural aroma of fresh wood hung in the air. The freshly cut blocks of pine still shed tears of sap. The shelves were crammed with hand-carved clogs, decorated with all manner of patterns, chimera, snakes, bull's heads. There was a pair in the shape of a pig's snout. One of the Germans looked at them appreciatively.
"Magnificent work," he said.
The morose, taciturn shoemaker didn't reply, but his wife, who was setting the table, was so curious she couldn't help but ask, "What did you do in Germany?" At first the soldier didn't understand. Then he said he'd been a locksmith. The shoemaker's wife thought for a moment, then whispered in her husband's ear, "We could show him that broken key to the dresser. Maybe he could fix it."
"Forget it," her husband said, frowning. "You? Lunch?" the soldier continued.
He pointed to the white bread on a plate decorated with flowers.
"French bread. Light. Not in stomach. Nothing."
What he meant was that the bread didn't seem nourishing, wouldn't fill you up. But the French couldn't believe anyone would be crazy enough not to recognize the excellence of their food, especially their golden round loaves, their crown-shaped breads. There were rumours they would soon have to be made with a mixture of bran and poor-quality flour, but no one believed it. They took the German's words as a compliment and were flattered. Even the sour expression on the shoemaker's face softened. He sat down at the table with his family. The Germans sat on wooden stools at a distance.
"And do you like this village?" the shoemaker's wife continued.
She was naturally sociable and suffered from her husband's long silences.
"Oh, yes, beautiful."
"And what about where you come from? Is it like here?"
she asked another soldier. The soldier's face began quivering. You could tell he was desperately trying to find the words to describe his own land, the fields of hop and deep forests. But he couldn't find the words. He just spread out his arms.
"Big. Good earth."
He hesitated and sighed.
"Far."
"Do you have a family?"
He nodded yes.
"You don't need to talk to them," the shoemaker said to his wife.
The woman felt ashamed. She continued working in silence, pouring the coffee, cutting the children's sandwiches. They could hear joyful sounds coming from outside. It was the cheerful din of laughter, weapons rattling, soldiers' voices and footsteps. No one quite knew why, but they felt light-hearted. Maybe it was because of the beautiful weather. The sky, so blue, seemed gently to bow down towards the horizon and caress the earth. The hens were squatting in the dust. Every so often they made sleepy squawking sounds and fluffed themselves up. Bits of straw, feathers, invisible grains of pollen floated in the air. It was the nesting season. There had been no men in the village for so long that even these soldiers, the invaders, seemed in their rightful place. The invaders felt it too. They stretched out in the sunshine. The mothers of prisoners or soldiers killed in the war looked at them and begged God to curse them. But the young women just looked at them. Chapter 7. In one of the classrooms of the independent school, The ladies of the village and some of the fat farmers' wives from the surrounding countryside had gathered together for the monthly Packages for Prisoners meeting. The village had taken responsibility for local children of prisoners of war who had been on welfare before the war. The charity's president was the Vicomtesse de Montmore. She was a shy, ugly young woman who got flustered whenever she had to speak in public. On each occasion she stuttered, her hands would sweat, her legs trembled. In short, she was just as prone to stage fright as any member of the aristocracy. But she felt it was an obligation, that it was her personal responsibility, her vocation, to enlighten the peasants and middle classes, to show them the way, to plant the seed of righteousness within them.
"You see, Amaury," she explained to her husband, "I cannot believe there is any essential difference between them and me. Even though they disappoint me, if you only knew how crude and petty they can be, nevertheless, I persist in trying to find some spark within them. Yes," she added, looking up at him with tears in her eyes, she cried easily, "yes, our Lord would not have died for such souls if there had been nothing inside them. But their ignorance, my dear, they are steeped in such ignorance that it is truly frightening. So, at the beginning of each meeting, I give them a little talk to help them understand why they are being punished. And go ahead and laugh, Amaury. I have sometimes seen a glimmer of understanding on their chubby faces. I do regret," the Vicomtesse thoughtfully concluded, "I do regret not having followed my vocation. I would have enjoyed preaching in an isolated region, working alongside some missionary in a savannah or virgin forest. Oh, well, best not to think about it. Our mission is here, where the good Lord has sent us."
She was standing on a small platform. The classroom had quickly been cleared of its desks. A dozen or so pupils deemed the most worthy had been allowed to come and hear the Vicomtesse speak. They were scraping their shoes on the floor and looking vacantly into space with their large, dull eyes. "Like cows," the Vicomtesse thought, feeling rather annoyed. She decided to speak directly to them.
"My dear girls," she said, "you have been the victims of our country's misfortunes at such a tender age."
One of the girls was listening so attentively that she fell off her wooden stool. The 11 other girls tried to stifle their riotous laughter in their aprons. The Vicomtesse frowned and continued more loudly.
"You play your childish games. You seem carefree, but your hearts are full of sadness. What fervent prayers you must offer to Almighty God, day and night, begging him to take pity on our dear, suffering France."
She paused and nodded curtly to the teacher who had just come in. She was a woman who did not attend mass and who had buried her husband in a civil ceremony. According to her pupils, she hadn't even been baptized, which seemed not so much scandalous as unbelievable, like saying someone had been born with the tail of a fish. As this person's conduct was irreproachable, the Vicomtesse hated her all the more, because, she explained to the Viscount,
"if she drank or had lovers, you could understand her lack of religion. But just imagine, Amaury, the confusion that can be caused in people's minds when they see virtue practiced by people who are not religious."
The presence of this teacher was so odious to the Vicomtesse that her voice took on the same burning passion that seeing the enemy stirs in our hearts, and it was with true eloquence that she continued,
"But our prayers, our tears are not enough. I say this not only to you, I say it to your mothers. We must be charitable. But what do I see? No one is charitable. No one puts other people first. I am not asking you for money. Alas, money doesn't mean very much anymore,"
the Vicomtesse said with a sigh, remembering she'd spent 850 francs on the shoe she was wearing. Fortunately, the Viscount was the local mayor, and she had coupons for shoes whenever she pleased.
"No, it isn't money. It's food I want to send in these packages to our prisoners of war. Food we have in such abundance in this region. Each one of you is thinking of your own relatives, your husband, son, brother, father, who is a prisoner. And nothing is too much for them. You send them butter, chocolate, sugar, tobacco. But what about the men who have no families? Oh, ladies, think of it. Just imagine the state of these poor wretches who never receive any packages, never receive any letters. Come now, what could you do for them? I'll collect all the donations, I'll sort them all out, I'll send them to the Red Cross to distribute them to the different stalags. What do you say, ladies?
They said nothing. The farmers' wives looked at the village ladies, who pursed their lips and stared back at them.
Come along now, I'll start, said the Viscountess sweetly. I have an idea. We could send a letter written by one of the children here in the next package, a letter that in simple, touching words would reveal their hearts and express their sorrowful, patriotic feelings. Just think, the Viscountess continued in an impassioned voice, just think of the joy a poor, abandoned soldier will feel when he reads those words, when he can almost touch, in a way, the very soul of his country. Their words will remind him of the men, the women, the children, the trees, the houses of his dear little home. And, as the poet said, loving our home makes us love our country even more. But most of all, my children, let your hearts speak. Do not aim for stylistic effect. Forget your letter-writing skills and speak from the heart. Ah, the heart, said the Viscountess, half-closing her eyes. Nothing beautiful, nothing great is accomplished without heart. You could put a little flower from the fields in your letter, a daisy or a primrose. I don't think that would be breaking any rules. Do you like that idea? The Viscountess asked, tilting her head slightly and smiling graciously. Come now, I've talked enough. It's your turn.
The notary's wife, a woman with hard features and a slight moustache, said sharply,
"It's not that we don't want to spoil our dear prisoners, but what can we poor villagers do? We have nothing. We don't have enormous estates like you, Viscountess, or big farms like the country folk. We can barely feed ourselves. My daughter just gave birth and can't even get any milk for her baby. Eggs cost 2 francs each, if you can find any."
"Are you saying we farmers are running a black market?" asked Cécile Savary, who was in the audience.
When she got angry, her neck swelled up like a turkey and her face went purplish-red.
"I'm not saying that, but—"
"Ladies, ladies," the Viscountess said softly, and she thought despondently, "Well, there you have it. There's nothing to be done. They feel nothing. They understand nothing. They have base souls. Oh! What am I thinking? Souls? They're nothing more than stomachs with the gift of speech."
"It's hurtful to hear you say that," Cécile continued. "It's hurtful to see you with your houses and having everything you want, and then to hear you cry poverty. Come on, everyone knows you villagers have everything. You hear me? Everything. You think we don't know you're getting all the meat? You buy up all the coupons. Everybody knows it. You pay 100 for each meat coupon. If you've got money, you want for nothing, that's for sure. While we poor people—"
"Well, of course we have to have meat, madame," said the notary's wife haughtily,
anxiously wondering if she'd been spotted coming out of the butcher's with a leg of lamb the day before, the second one that week.
"We don't have pigs we can kill. We don't have hams in our kitchens, tubs of lard, and cured sausages we'd rather see eaten by worms than give them to the miserable people in the village."
"Ladies, ladies," the Viscountess implored, "think of France. Elevate your hearts. Control yourselves. Silence these hurtful remarks. Think of our situation. We are ruined, defeated. We have only one consolation, our dear Maréchal. And all you can talk about is eggs, milk, pigs. How important is food? Really, ladies, this is all so vulgar."
"We have so many other things to worry about.
What is really important in the end? Helping each other a little tolerance. Let us unite, just as the soldiers in the last war did in the trenches, just as I'm sure our dear prisoners of war are doing in their camps, behind their barbed wire fences. It was strange. They'd barely been listening to her until now. Her imploring had been like a priest's sermon you hear without understanding, but the image of a German prisoner of war camp, with men herded behind barbed wire, touched them. Every one of these large, heavy women had someone they loved in one of those camps. They were working for him. They were saving for him. They were putting money aside for his return, so he could say, "You really took care of everything. You're a good wife." Each woman pictured her absent man, just hers. Each woman imagined, in her own way, the place he was held captive. One thought of a pine forest, another of a cold room, yet another of fortress-like walls. But each of them ended up imagining miles of barbed wire surrounding their men and isolating them from the rest of the world. The farmers' wives and villagers alike felt their eyes fill with tears.
"I'll bring you something," one of them said.
"Me too," said another with a sigh. "I'll manage to find a bit of something."
"I'll see what I can do," promised the notary's wife.
Madame de Montmort hurried to write down their promises. Every one of the women stood up, went over to the president and whispered something in her ear, because now they were all deeply moved and touched. They truly wanted to give, not only to their sons and husbands, but to strangers, to children on welfare. However, they didn't trust each other. They didn't want to seem richer than they were. They feared being denounced. There wasn't a single household that didn't hide its provisions. Mothers and daughters spied on each other, denounced each other. Housewives closed their kitchen doors at mealtime so they wouldn't be betrayed by the smell of lard sizzling in the pot, or the piece of prohibited meat, or the cake made with illegal flour. Madame de Montmort wrote down, "Madame Bracelet, farmer's wife in Les Rouaches, 2 sausages, a pot of honey, a jar of potted meat. Madame Joseph from the Rouet estate, 2 potted guinea fowl, some salted butter, chocolate, coffee, sugar." "I can count on you, can't I, ladies?" the Viscountess said again. But the farmers' wives just stared at her, astonished. They never went back on their word. They said goodbye to the Viscountess, holding out their red hands that were chafed by the harsh winter, by caring for animals, by doing the washing. She shook each hand, reluctantly. Touching them was physically distasteful to her, but she made the effort to overcome this feeling so contrary to Christian charity, and, in the spirit of mortification, forced herself to kiss the children who accompanied their mothers. They were all fat and pink, overfed and with dirty faces, like little pigs. At last the room was empty. The teacher had taken the girls out. The farmers' wives were gone. The Viscountess sighed. Not from tiredness, but from disgust. How base and ugly people were. You have to go to so much trouble to instill a glimmer of love into these sad souls, she said to herself out loud. But, as her spiritual adviser had suggested, she offered up her day's tiredness and work to God.
Chapter 8. "And what do the French think, monsieur, of the outcome of the war?" Bonnet asked.
The women looked at each other, scandalized. It just wasn't done. You simply didn't talk to a German about the war, not about this one or the other one, or about Maréchal Pétain, or about Marcel Kabir, or about how France had been split in two, or about the occupying forces, or about anything that mattered.
There was only one possible attitude— an affectation of cold indifference, the tone of voice Benoit used as he raised his glass full to the brim with red wine.
"They don't give a damn, monsieur."
It was evening. The setting sun, clear and crisp, was a sign there would be a frost that night, but that the next day would undoubtedly be magnificent. Bonnet had spent all day in the village and was on his way to bed. But before going up, he had lingered downstairs out of politeness, natural kindness, the desire to be well regarded,
or perhaps simply the wish to warm himself a moment by the fire. Dinner was almost over. Benoit was alone at the table. The women had already got up and were tidying the room, doing the dishes. The German looked at the big, useless bed with curiosity. No one sleeps here, do they? It isn't used for anything. How odd. Sometimes it's used, said Madeleine, thinking of Jean-Marie. She thought no one would guess, but Benoit frowned. Every allusion to what had happened that past summer pierced straight through his heart like an arrow, but it was his business and no one else's. He looked reproachfully at Cécile, who had started to snigger.
Sometimes it can be useful, he replied with excessive politeness. You never know. If something bad happened to you, for example, not that I'd want it to. Around here we lay out our dead on beds like this.
Bonnette looked at him, amused, with the same scornful pity you feel when a wild animal grinds its teeth behind the bars of its cage. Fortunately, he thought, this man will be busy working and won't be around too often. And the women are more approachable. He smiled.
In wartime, none of us wants to die in a bed.
Madeleine, meanwhile, had gone out into the garden. She came back with some flowers to decorate the mantelpiece. They were the first lilacs of the season, as white as snow, with greenish tips. At the top of each stem, the clusters of flowers were still in bud, but further down, they opened out into perfumed blooms. Bonnet lowered his pale face deep inside the bouquet.
How divine! And how well you know how to arrange flowers!
For a second, they stood silently, side by side. Benoit thought that she, his wife, his Madeleine, always seemed comfortable when it came to doing ladies' work, when she chose flowers, polished her nails, wore her hair differently from the other women in the area, when she spoke to strangers, held a book.
People shouldn't take in foster children. You never know where they come from, he said to himself.
Once more that painful thought. When he said, you don't know where they come from, what he imagined, what he was afraid of, wasn't that Madeleine might come from a family of alcoholics or thieves, but from the middle classes. Perhaps it was that which made her sigh and say, oh, it's so boring in the countryside, or I want to have pretty things I do. And it was that which made her feel some vague bond with strangers, with the enemy, so long as he happened to be a gentleman with fine clothes and clean hands. He pushed his chair back angrily and went outside. It was time to get the animals in. He stayed in the warm darkness of the stables for a long time. A cow had given birth the day before. She tenderly licked her little calf with its big head, its thin, trembling legs. Another cow was breathing quietly in the corner. He listened to her calm, deep breaths. From where he was, he could see the open door of the house. A shape appeared on the doorstep. Someone was worried because he hadn't come back. They were looking for him. His mother or Madeleine? His mother, no doubt. Just his mother, sadly. He wouldn't move from here until the German had gone upstairs. He'd see his light go on. Sure, electricity didn't cost him anything. He was right. After a few moments, a light shone through the window. At the same time, the shadowy figure who'd been looking for him left the doorstep and ran lightly towards him. He felt his heart soften, as if some invisible hand had suddenly lifted the burden that had weighed so heavily on his chest for so long that he felt crushed by it.
That you, Benoit?
Yes, I'm over here.
What are you doing? I was scared.
Scared of what? You're crazy.
I don't know. Come in.
Wait. Wait a little.
He pulled her towards him. She struggled and pretended to laugh, but he could sense by a kind of stiffening throughout her body that she didn't really want to laugh, that she didn't find it funny, that she didn't like being thrown down in the hay and cool straw. She didn't like it. No, she didn't like him. She got no pleasure from him. He said very quietly in a low voice, is there nothing you like?
There is. But not here, not like this, Benoit. I'm embarrassed.
Why, you think the cows might see you? He said harshly. Fine, go on, get out.
She let out the despondent little moan that made him want to cry and kill her at the same time. "The way you talk to me. Sometimes I think you're cross with me. For what? It's Cecile who's..." He put his hand over her mouth. She quickly pulled away and continued, "She's the one who's getting you all worked up."
"No one's getting me worked up. I don't need other people's eyes to see, do I? All I know is, whenever I come near you, it's always, wait, not now, not tonight. The baby's worn me out. Who are you waiting for?" he roared suddenly. "Who are you saving yourself for? Well? Well?
Let go of me," she cried as he grabbed hold of her. "Let go of me, you're hurting me." He pushed her away so violently that she hit her head on the low doorframe. They looked at each other for a moment in silence. He picked up a rake and angrily stabbed at the hay. "You're wrong," Madeleine said finally. Then whispered tenderly, "Benoit, poor dear Benoit, you're wrong to think such things. Come on, I'm your wife. If I seem cold sometimes, it's because the baby wears me out, that's all."
"Let's get out of here," he said suddenly. "Let's go up to bed."
They went into the dark, empty house. There was a little light left in the sky and at the tops of the trees. Everything else, the earth, the house, the meadows, was plunged into cool darkness. They undressed and got into bed. That night he didn't try to take her. They lay awake, motionless, listening to the German's breathing above their heads, the creaking of his bed. In the darkness, Madeleine reached for her husband's hand and squeezed it tightly. "Benoit."
"What?"
"Benoit, I just remembered. You have to hide your shotgun. Did you read the posters in town?"
"Yes," he said sarcastically. "Verboten, verboten, death. That's all they know how to say, the bastards."
"Where are you going to hide it?"
"Forget it. It's fine where it is."
"Benoit, don't be stubborn. It's serious. You know how many people have been shot for not turning in their weapons."
"You want me to give them my gun?" "Only chickens do that. I'm not scared of them. You want to know how I got away last summer? I killed two of them. They didn't know what hit them. And I'll kill some more," he said furiously, shaking his fist in the dark at the German upstairs.
"I'm not saying you should hand it in. Just hide it. Bury it. There are plenty of good hiding places."
"Can't."
"Why not?"
"I've got to have it to hand. You think I'm going to let the foxes near us? Or all the other stinking beasts? Chateau grounds are crawling with them. The Viscount, he's a real coward. He's shaking in his boots. He couldn't kill a thing. Now there's one who'd handed in his gun to the Commandant, and with a nice little salute to boot. You're very welcome, monsieur. I'm truly honoured." "Lucky me and my friends go up to his grounds at night. Otherwise the whole area would be overrun."
"Don't they hear the gunshots?"
"Of course not. It's enormous, almost a forest."
"Do you go there often?" said Madeleine, curious. "I didn't know."
"There's lots of things you don't know, my girl. We go looking for his young tomato plants and beetroot, fruit, anything he's not taking to market." "The Viscount." He paused for a moment, plunged in thought, then added, "The Viscount, he's one of the worst."
For generations, the Sabaris had been tenants of the Montmorels. For generations, they had hated each other. The Sabaris said the Montmorels were mean to the poor, haughty, shifty. The Montmorels accused their tenants of having a bad attitude. They whispered these words as they shrugged their shoulders and raised their eyes to heaven. It was an expression that meant far more than even the Montmorels thought. The Sabaris' way of perceiving poverty, wealth, peace, war, freedom, property, was not in itself less logical than the Montmorels, but it was as contrary to theirs as fire is to water. Now there was even more to complain about. The way the Viscount saw it, Benoit had been a soldier in 1940, and in the end it was the soldiers' lack of discipline, their lack of patriotism, their bad attitude that had been responsible for the defeat. Benoit, on the other hand, saw in Montmore one of those dashing officers in their tan boots, who, during those June days, had headed towards the Spanish border in their expensive cars, with their wives and suitcases. Then had come
collaboration. He licks the German's boots, Benoit said darkly.
Be careful, said Madeleine. You say what you think too much, and don't be rude to that German up there.
If he starts chasing after you, well,
you're crazy. I have eyes. Are you going to be jealous of him too?
Madeleine exclaimed. She regretted it as soon as she had said it. She shouldn't have given substance to her jealous husband's imagination. But after all, what was the use of keeping quiet about something they both knew?
They're both the same to me, Benoit replied.
These well-groomed, clean-cut men, with their quick, witty way of talking, the girls are drawn to them in spite of themselves because they're flattered to be sought after by gentlemen. That's what he means, thought Madeleine. If only he knew she'd loved Jean-Marie from the first moment, the very first moment she saw him lying on that stretcher, exhausted, covered in mud, in his bloody uniform. Loved, yes. Lying in the dark, deep in that secret part of her heart, she repeated to herself over and over again, I loved him. There it is. I still love him. I can't help it. At dawn, the husky crow of the cock pierced the silence and put an end to their sleepless night. They both got up. She went to make the coffee, he to tend the animals. Chapter 9. Lucie Langelier sat in the shade of the cherry trees with a book and some embroidery. It was the only corner of the garden where trees and plants were left to grow untended, for these cherry trees bore little fruit. But it was blossom time. Against a sky of pure and relentless blue, that deep but lustrous Sèvres blue seen on certain precious pieces of porcelain, floated branches that appeared to be covered in snow. The breath of wind that moved them was still chilly on this day in May. The flowers gently resisted, curling up with a kind of trembling grace and turning their pale stamens towards the ground. The sun shone through them, revealing a pattern of interlacing, delicate blue veins visible through the opaque petals. This added something alive to the flower's fragility, to its ethereal quality, something almost human, in the way that human can mean frailty and endurance both at the same time. The wind could ruffle these ravishing creations, but it couldn't destroy them or even crush them. They swayed there, dreamily. They seemed ready to fall, but held fast to their slim, strong branches, branches that had something silvery about them, like the trunk itself, which grew tall and straight, sleek and slender, tinged with greys and purples. Between the clusters of white flowers were long, thin leaves. In the shade they looked a delicate green, covered in silvery down. In the sunlight they seemed pink. The garden ran alongside a narrow road, a country lane dotted with little cottages. This was where the Germans had set up their ammunition store. A guard marched up and down beneath a red sign that said in large letters, Verboten, and further down, in small writing in French, Keep out under penalty of death. The soldiers whistled as they groomed their horses, and the horses ate the green shoots of the young trees. In the gardens bordering the road, men calmly went about their work. In shirt sleeves, corduroy trousers and straw hats, they tilled, pruned, watered, sowed, planted. Sometimes a German soldier would push open the gate of one of these little gardens to ask for a match to light his pipe, or for a fresh egg or a glass of beer. The gardener would give him what he wanted, then, leaning on his spade and lost in thought, watch him walk away, before turning back to his work with a shrug of the shoulders that was no doubt a reaction to a world of thoughts, so numerous, so deep, so serious and strange, that it was impossible to express them in words. Lucille began to embroider, but soon set down her work. The cherry blossom above her head was attracting wasps and bees. They were coming and going, darting about, diving into the centre of the flowers and drinking greedily, heads down and bodies trembling with a sort of spasmodic delight, while a great golden bumblebee, seemingly mocking these agile workers, swayed in the soft breeze as if on a hammock, barely moving and filling the air with its peaceful golden hum. From her seat, Lucille could see their German officer at the window. For a few days now he'd had the regiment's Alsatian with him. He was in Gaston Angelier's room, sitting at the Louis XIV desk. He emptied the ashes from his pipe into the blue cup that the elder Madame Angelier used for her son's herbal tea. He tapped his heel absent-mindedly against the gilt bronze mounts that supported the table. The dog had put his snout on the German's leg. He barked and pulled on his chain.
"No, booby,"
the officer told him in French, and loud enough for Lucille to hear. In this quiet garden, all sound hung in the air for a long time, as if carried by the gentle breeze.
"You can't go running about. You will eat all these ladies' lettuces, and they will not be happy with you. They will think we are all bad-mannered, crude soldiers. You must stay where you are, booby, and look at the beautiful garden."
What a child, Lucille thought. But she couldn't help smiling. The officer continued,
"It's a shame, isn't it, booby? You would love to make holes in the garden with your nose, I'm sure. If there were a small child in the house, it would be different. He'd call us over. We've always got along well with small children. But here there are only two very serious ladies, very silent, and we are better off staying where we are, booby."
He waited another moment, and when Lucille said nothing, he seemed disappointed. He leaned further out of the window, saluted her, and asked with excessive politeness, "Would it inconvenience you in any way, madame, if I were to ask your permission to pick the strawberries in your flower beds?"
"Make yourself at home," said Lucille with bitter irony.
The officer saluted again.
"I wouldn't take the liberty of asking you for myself, I assure you, but this dog loves strawberries. I would point out as well that it is a French dog. He was found in an abandoned village in Normandy during a battle and taken in by my comrades. You wouldn't refuse to give your strawberries to a fellow Frenchman."
"We must be idiots," thought Lucille. But all she said was, "Come, both of you, and pick whatever you like."
"Thank you, madame,"
the officer exclaimed happily, and immediately jumped out of the window, the dog following behind. The two of them came up to Lucille. The German smiled.
"I hope you don't mind me asking, madame. Please do not think me rude. It's just that this garden, these cherry trees, it all seems like a little corner of paradise to a simple soldier."
"Did you spend the winter in France?" Lucille asked.
"Yes, in the north, confined to the barracks and the café by the bad weather. I was billeted with a poor young woman whose husband had been taken prisoner 2 weeks after they got married. Whenever she saw me in the hallway, she started to cry. As for me, well, it made me feel like a criminal, though it wasn't my fault, and I could have told her I was married too and separated from my wife by the war."
"You're married?"
"Yes. Does that surprise you? Married 4 years. A soldier 4 years."
"But you're so young."
"I'm 24, madame."
They fell silent.